In the year 2000, private investigators approached janitors at the building location of the Association for Competitive Technology. They were offering $1,200 to the janitors to go through their garbage. Why? The association was suspected of having close ties with Microsoft while claiming to be an independent organization. At the time, Microsoft was famously being investigated by the Department of Justice of the United States for antitrust violations. But what did this association have to do with the case? Well, nothing, really, because the Department of Justice doesn't hire private investigators to go through garbage. The PIs were hired by Oracle, a tech giant company and business rival of Microsoft's. When caught and called out for conducting this bizarre investigation, Oracle claimed it was doing its civic duty by exposing Microsoft's attempts to sway public opinion during a major antitrust case. CEO of Oracle, Larry Ellison, said they were trying to expose Microsoft, saying, "It's absolutely true we set out to expose Microsoft's covert activities. I feel very good about what we did." Ellison went on to say, "It's our job to hurt Microsoft."
Welcome to Meridians.
Welcome to Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble. Today I'm talking about competition. Whether it's competing for resources, prestige, power, we'll look at that aspect of human nature that seems to drive us in some ways, but also gets us in a lot of trouble in others. So let's just get right into it. I mentioned Microsoft and Oracle, so let's get into that and see where this journey leads us. So in 1998, the Department of Justice in the United States and 20 states filed an antitrust lawsuit against Microsoft. The reason was pretty well understood to anyone who operated a computer in the 1990s. The tech giant was the tech giant at the time. They were the most valuable company in the world, with just a few billion dollars larger than GE. GE was $257 billion in value, and Microsoft had about $4 billion more at $261 billion. And their success was due almost entirely to their Windows operating system, of course. Windows 98 sold 1 million retail licenses within weeks of its release. The Office 97 suite was selling really well at the time. And on the enterprise side, Windows NT saw like 200% growth in 12 months. They were on fire. They were tremendously successful. So why'd they get this antitrust lawsuit filed against them? Why also was Oracle so hell-bent on attacking them? The antitrust suit is long and complex, so I'll just give the cliff notes. But basically, a judge ruled that Microsoft had used monopoly power to stifle competition. A big part of this was that Microsoft made it difficult for consumers to uninstall Internet Explorer and use competing web browsers on their software. They basically packaged Internet Explorer into their operating system for free, making it hard to compete in the browser market. It basically killed the Netscape browser, which had been dominant for quite a while in the 90s, or for a few years anyway. So let's get back to Larry Ellison now, the CEO of Oracle, who seemed to feel justified in his illegal activity spying on Microsoft. Ellison actually started his career as a computer programmer in the 1970s, working for Ampex Corporation, where he worked on a project developing a database for the CIA. He named this database Oracle. He would then go on to found a company of the same name selling database technology. and their product would be called the Oracle Database. It was released in 1979. Oracle would go through booms and busts over the years, and even a few small scandals, until about the mid-90s, where they started to dominate this database market, after basically defeating their chief rivals, Sybase and Informix. In the late 90s, then also, Informix would be swallowed up by Microsoft and rebranded as Microsoft SQL Server. So now, Larry Ellison and Oracle sees Microsoft with their SQL Server as their next big rival to crush, to attack. But Microsoft is a totally different beast to the other competitors they've had. Microsoft was very dominant at the time. There just wasn't any software company nearly the size of them. Oracle itself was only 22 billion in 1998, and Microsoft was, you know, more than 10 times that at $261 billion in value. So when Microsoft was charged with antitrust violations in 1998, Oracle saw their vulnerability and wanted to attack. They wanted the worst possible scenario for Microsoft in their antitrust suit, and they were willing to do anything to help make that happen. So during the investigation by the DOJ, polls and studies were being put out by these tech research groups. Certain groups were putting out polls and research that clearly supported Microsoft's position in the antitrust suit. They're trying to gain public opinion for Microsoft. Larry Ellison and Oracle were convinced that these groups were actually secretly working on behalf of Microsoft. There were three such research groups under suspicion by Oracle: the Independence Institute, the National Taxpayers Union, and the Association for Competitive Technology. And Oracle then hired IGI, an investigation group, to investigate these other associations and see what they could find. IGI was certainly qualified for this. They'd been involved in high-profile cases before. They were hired by Clinton's lawyers during the 1994 Paula Jones sexual misconduct lawsuit against the then president. And they'd also done what's called opposition research. In 1991, they would investigate activities of Mike Tyson's accusers and whether his jurors in his rape trial acted appropriately. So they were pretty high-profile investigators and seemed willing to do kind of whatever was necessary, whatever the seedy job that it was. And this was pretty seedy work. After all, they were digging through trash. And I'm sorry, I have to say this because I kind of find it funny. Oracle owns Java. Java is a programming language. And a funny thing about this language is it has something in it called garbage collection. It has to do with memory and cleaning up memory, and it has nothing to do with corporate espionage, but I kind of find it funny for some reason, you know, you get it. Anyway, Oracle hires IGI. These guys apparently paid janitors $1,200 for access to their trash, or they at least tried to. The word got out to national news that they were trying to do this, and it became sort of a talking point for a little while. And Oracle says they insisted on only legal methods be used in this investigation, but then went on to also say they were doing their civic duty, yada, 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 and that they gathered enough evidence to indicate these are not independent groups, as they pretend to be. And they proved that these organizations were paid for by Microsoft's public affairs and legal departments. So Microsoft called their actions disturbing and accused Oracle of engaging in a campaign to tarnish Microsoft's public image. Well, yeah, Microsoft, come on, player's gonna play. That's what Oracle's out to do. So Oracle's interesting, especially Larry Ellison. In 2000, Time magazine said this of Larry Ellison: ruthless, competitiveness, love of the spotlight, a preternatural obsession with Microsoft and Bill Gates, and a management style that sometimes has an inmates running the asylum feel. Not the most flattering words from Time magazine. Of course, Oracle's claims against Microsoft's did have some validity, the Independent Institute. Yes, the Independent Institute, one of those three groups accused by Oracle of serving Microsoft, would take out large full-page ads in national newspapers supporting Microsoft without disclosing that they were, yes, they were in fact funded in large part by Microsoft. This information had been leaked to the media, and it's highly speculated that it was leaked by IGI on behalf of Oracle. So while Oracle might have had a point here, they kind of crossed some ethical boundaries themselves. And upon looking into Oracle a little bit more, they've got quite an interesting company. Here's a little story. Get a load of this. In 2004, John Ashcroft was the acting Attorney General for the United States. And he sued Oracle to try to block an acquisition of a company. So probably more like probably couched in terms of that it's anti-competitive behavior. And he sued them to try to block this acquisition. The very next year, Ashcroft was now resigned. He's resigned from Attorney General, and he starts a consulting company and starts contracting for Oracle for hundreds of thousands of dollars. $220,000 from Oracle, to be exact. Less than 1 month after Ashcroft was working with Oracle, this multi-billion dollar acquisition Oracle was making was approved. And this absolutely, obviously reeks of corruption. Must be some real need for a lawyer at Oracle, right? Like $220,000 the first month, and then suddenly he does an about face and helps them get approved on this deal. This just sounds really fishy. And when doing research on Oracle, I came across Y Combinator. It's kind of an IT professional's like message board. And somebody said, Oracle? The law firm with an IT department? I guess that's just a thing with Oracle. Several on the site were just calling them a litigation company and nothing more than patent trolls. Today, Oracle is still a very litigious company. Their big competitor is still Microsoft, but Larry Ellison is now one of the richest people on Earth. And what I found interesting about this scandal in particular was that I didn't expect that when I'd researched these companies that both sides, everyone involved in this situation was kind of scummy in their own way. Just corruption, politics, corporate espionage, they just seem to go together kind of like peanut butter and jelly. It's just kind of maddening that these people are the first people on TV as well. They're just talking about capitalism and democracy and preaching ethics and morals. Meanwhile, they're doing everything they can to just win no matter what. They just want to win. They're all competing with each other. And it's the race to the bottom to see who will go lower ethically. And Microsoft actually lost their lawsuit and were supposed to be forced to break up, sort of. But this was the year 2000. And in the year 2001, Microsoft would win their appeals, sort of. The company was required to appoint a panel of three people who would have full access to Microsoft systems, records, and source code for 5 years. And Microsoft was prohibited from retaliating against computer makers who used non-Microsoft software. No such ruling for Oracle, obviously. They weren't on trial here, but also notice the year 2000 to 2001. The difference being we went from a Democratic president to a Republican president. I'm not saying for sure that had anything to do with it, but it's certainly curious. But after that, it did mark a point where Microsoft started to lose market share, and it might have just been from other forces, but they still dominate the personal computer market with 72% of computers, desktops, having Windows. And then across all devices, Microsoft's actually down to 26% of the market, but that's likely due to the rise of smartphones came in the late 2010s or 2000s, really. So now let's take a look at another example of corporate espionage. We're going to examine several fun ones now, not long stories, just a few quick hits. So Let's check them out. Okay, so not all corporate espionage is created equally. Here's another one that's it's from a different perspective. Sometimes the company truly is the victim. Such was the case with Kodak and Harold Warden. This was back in the 1990s as well, so it's really a scandalous time, I suppose. But Warden worked for Kodak for 28 years, and he quit. Why he did quit isn't entirely clear, but he might have just kind of retired. He seemed like he was semi-retired. Maybe he got fed up with something at work, or maybe he was just getting greedy. He quits Kodak, and he starts this consulting firm. Okay, here we go. So he seems like he was sort of semi-retired and started collecting trade secrets on Kodak through other retirees from the company that he knew. He must not have been very careful about this, gathering information, you know, not really disguising what he's trying to do. But so one of them must have gotten suspicious, because Kodak got wind of this and set up a sting operation to catch Warden in the act of trying to sell secrets. And there was this four-hour meeting in which Kodak executive and security consultant posed as employees of a phony Chinese company that was wanting to break into the modern film manufacturing industry. So they videotaped the whole meeting to use as evidence. And at first, the meeting kind of, Warden seems to exonerate himself, saying he wouldn't sell patented technology. But as the conversation went on, he ended up giving them enough evidence to take it to the FBI. And then they took over and then seized 40,000 documents from Warden's home that he'd been stockpiling to sell. So Warden was arrested. He would plead guilty and serve 15 months in prison, as well as paying up to $53,000 in penalties as part of the plea bargain. So he basically knew he was cooked, and he just made a deal. And so it's kind of an interesting one, where the company is the victim, corporate secrets, not something that they play around with. But so here's another case, though. It's a really stupid one, to be honest, but what if a company is a victim of itself? Yeah, it sounds really dumb, because it is. In 2005 to 2006, HP was having issues, more specifically, HP's board was having issues with internal secrets hitting the media. Some of these secrets were known only to the HP board, and leaks in the company were getting out. So in response to this, Patricia Dunn, who was the non-executive chair of the board at the time, hired a company to investigate the other board members. Yeah, the chair of the HP board was investigating her other board members. This is not going to go well. So you've probably heard these stories too, like tech leaks, you know, about the next bit of innovation, or maybe just a board leaking information. Half the time the leaks are on purpose, but these leaks seem like they were important to keep secret for HP, so it was an individual acting alone. So things got pretty sleazy pretty quick. These investigators that Patricia Dunn hired obtained personal information about the board members, including their social security numbers, full names, addresses, and phone numbers. And then they'd call the phone company posing as these board members to try to obtain their phone records so they could prove that they were leaking it. And this phone record collection even extended to journalists who had actually done the reporting that leaked the insider info. So kind of poor judgment on behalf of Patricia Dunn. The juice was not worth the squeeze, lady. They did figure out who the leaker was, and he resigned. It was George Keyworth. But this whole investigation scandal came out too. Patricia Dunn claimed not to know the methods the investigators would use, but come on, you shouldn't have initiated this in the first place. It's just stupid. She would later leave the board because of the distraction her presence on the board created. So some companies are just their own worst enemies, and these two stories aren't even really about competition, are they? Well, maybe they are. In the case of the Kodak guy, he was kind of semi-retired. Why steal secrets? Greed? Keeping up with the Joneses? Was it that kind of thing? Maybe Warden had like a rich brother-in-law and he saw a way to one-up him. You know, all of his life he's been one-upped by the other family members he has, and, oh, you just work at Kodak. They aren't paying you much, huh? You can imagine how that could go. Maybe it was just simple greed, though. But what about the HP case? Like, why was the board member leaking information? Well, he was leaking information about board deliberations. I mean, my guess is that he was doing that because leaking that information helped promote whatever his angle was on the board. Maybe there was a disagreement, and by outing some of the stances to the public, it was harming his opposition on the board. And I'd call that a very competitive move in that case. But what about in the past? Now, let's look at a different story. Like, has corporate espionage always been a thing? Is this a more recent thing? Well, it's kind of always been a thing, but not all companies exist. Corporations are a relatively new thing, but there was a corporation back in 1848, a sort of a company. And it was the British East India Company. I didn't realize that the manufacture of tea is actually a pretty delicate and complicated process. But back in 1848, it was a closely guarded secret of China. And the British had already been hooked on Chinese tea, and they had been for at least a few hundred years. And as a side note, this got me thinking, that meant that all that tea that was spilled in Boston, you know, on the American Revolution, Boston Tea Party, that would have been tea sent all the way from China. So it's not like, it was kind of a big deal to be dumping that tea. It wasn't cheap at the time. So they, the British, were depending on Chinese tea, and they were basically controlling India at the time as well. It's 1848, and the British East India Company was there in India, being pioneers in corporate skullduggery and scumbaggery as they were. And so the East India Company decided they were going to figure out how to grow and manufacture tea for themselves and for Britain. Why should China hoard all this wealth, they thought. So I can actually picture this. It just seems like kind of a historical comedy. It's so ridiculous what they did. They sent a man named Robert Fortune on a trip to China's interior. They sent him in disguise, dressed up in Mandarin garb, trying to pass as a Chinese official, or something of that manner. He also hired a Chinese guy, guide, sort of, to act as his servant, walking five paces in front of him, you know, trying to really sell this whole thing, make himself look important. He isn't even supposed to be visiting the interior in China. For just to understand, it was forbidden to foreigners, but he showed up in disguise at this green tea factory asking if the master of the factory would allow a visit from an honored guest, an official from a far province. So that's what his interpreter, his assistant, quote-unquote assistant guy, would announce. And so they let him in. And this has to be really a risky thing for Robert Fortune to do. In the 1850s, I have no doubt he would have seen the inside of a Chinese jail for several years if they didn't outright kill him. I don't know. Why would he take these risks? It's tea. It's just business. It's just money, right? It's not worth risking your life for, is it? But greed and corruption, they have played a part in this one for sure. Or maybe even a bit of glory, right? Robert Fortune, he wanted to return to India maybe as some kind of company hero, or maybe he'd be like a national hero, the tea hero of Great Britain. I don't know. Anyway, he stole every kind of secret he could. How to dry tea, how they'd cook the tea, the materials they used to do it, how long it took to make green tea versus black tea. He even stole seeds and learned the proper horticultural techniques needed to properly grow these plants. And China had this long history where they developed all these techniques over millennia, and this guy just shows up and basically just steals it. Basically just like that. And the East India Company was so successful with this little campaign, this little ruse, that today, India, while it's no longer under British control, it is the second largest tea exporter in the world. And it was kind of down to this little covert trip that Robert Fortune made. So if you want to learn more about this, check out the book For All the Tea in China, How England Stole the World's Favorite Drink and Changed History by Sarah Rose. That's where I got a lot of that information from. And this whole thing with the tea, it was kind of part of a bigger trade imbalance with the British, where they were concerned about with China. I mean, a trade imbalance with China, you know, some things never change. But because of this imbalance, British merchants and the British East India Company, they were trying to sell as much opium to China at the time, despite it being illegal in China. And this is just for economic gains. They're just selling opium. And they were fully aware of how harmful and addictive opium could be, but they just didn't care. They were just scumbags. Like, it was all about money. They put profit over people because, well, they weren't our people. It's probably how they looked at it. But now for our final espionage saga, I want to go through the details of a really fascinating story that it just happened in 2019, but it probably kind of flew under the radar because COVID hit a year later, and, you know, everybody kind of forgot about it. But we're going to talk about the bidding scandal that happened at TDC in Denmark. I found most of this information from a story Bloomberg did on this. They've got a video about it on YouTube. The video is titled Intrigue in Copenhagen, A Tale of High-Stakes Corporate Espionage. So TDC is a large Danish telecom company. It's the largest telecom firm in Denmark. Looks like they've got a long history in Denmark, and they go back, way back to the days of the telegraph and setting up early phone lines. So they're kind of one of these like AT&T type of, they're an institutional, well-established company. So in early 2019, they, like many large telecom companies, were looking to expand their 5G network. They had put a tender contract out that was worth $200 million for a supplier who could build out this network for them. It was an offer put out, like open to bidders to do this work. So eventually, you know, they took all these bids, but eventually the bidding process was whittled down to two companies, the Swedish company Ericsson and the Chinese company Huawei. And the bidding process, it's obviously kept very secret at TDC. Only the leadership team at TDC knows the details of the bids. So we're talking like 5 to 10 people at the company. So Ericsson actually came in with a lower bid than Huawei. It looked like they were going to win the contract. But on March 5th, before the bidding and deals were all closed, Huawei submitted this emergency change to their bid and actually undercut Ericsson slightly. TDC smells something fishy. This was a really suspicious move by Huawei. So their security team then begins this investigation into maybe there was a leak. So they start looking into maybe there's an insider, which is kind of unlikely since, you know, very few people knew about this deal, and they were the leadership of the company. There was also a certain concern of hackers and also the possibility of eavesdropping. So to check for eavesdropping, they did a sweep of the building, checking for hidden microphones or recording devices, probably not expecting to really find anything, but they do find something. They found that several of their boardrooms had been bugged, and they were bugged with fairly sophisticated equipment. And now at this point, they don't really know who did it though, or why. For all they know, it could have been Ericsson who put the bugs there. So the team starts reviewing security footage, and they quickly discover who put the bugs there. It sounds like they figured that out. It was Dov Goldstein who was responsible for the leaks. but it's not made exactly clear from what I've seen, but it just seems like he was the one that planted. They don't explicitly say he planted the bugs, but it's kind of a read between the lines sort of a thing. But it gets even weirder, though. Goldstein somehow finds out that they're investigating him and confronts the executives at TDC. This really upsets the security team because now they think, holy crap, we might have a leak in our own investigation. So it could be somebody on the board or, you know, or somebody in the leadership team. So it wasn't clear who they expected, but I was guessing they were worried about more bugs or possibly other employees eavesdropping on their investigation. So the security team decides they can't continue at headquarters, and they decide to take their investigation off campus. They seize all the executives' laptops and phones, and they head out. Probably not the easiest day for the security team. So they move their investigation off-site to the Plesner Law Firm. It's there that they rent out a conference room on the 15th floor to conduct this investigation from. That same night, the Plesner Law Firm, their computer network starts coming under attack from some unknown source. They don't seem to gain any access, but it's very suspicious. Worse yet, later after midnight, a security guard at the law firm notices a drone hovering outside of a window of the firm. It was right outside the 15th floor conference room window that the TDC security team was conducting their investigation from. Like, what the hell, right? They've got drones hovering outside their windows, hackers trying to break in, all over a 5G contract, remember? So the team started noticing they were being followed in their comings and goings from the law firm during this investigation. Even the CEO, she was involved in the investigation. You know, she was kind of probably keeping tabs on it. Even she was being followed. But during this time, Huawei actually tried to apply some pressure to have TDC accept this contract. You know, they were kind of holding up signing this contract until this investigation was over. So in a letter, Huawei contacted the Danish government in a letter, and they said, Huawei's possible predicament in Denmark will severely affect other Chinese companies' investment confidence in Denmark. We sincerely hope that Denmark will maintain an open and fair business environment with a level playing field for all companies. Pretty suspicious. They're not being very subtle at this, like, cloak and dagger stuff, right? They're practically threatening them. It's obviously them behind this. They're doing a terrible job keeping this quiet and avoiding suspicion. I mean, they got drones flying around, hackers. They're basically making threats. Obviously, they were suspected to be behind the leak from the start since they were the most to gain. And they made this change to their bid. So the investigation would take 2.5 months, and they would conclude that yes, Dove Goldstein did in fact leak the contract information. And they even figured out who he leaked it to. He leaked this information to Jason Lan, who was the head of operations for Huawei in Denmark. Huawei is the biggest maker of telecom communications equipment in the world. And they actually have a strong history with working with TDC. They actually have an office on the TDC campus. They'd been heavily involved in building out TDC's 3G and 4G networks. So they were really trusted partners. They worked together in the past. So TDC had to do this due diligence. That's why this investigation would take so long. They really had to be sure about their conclusions about Huawei, because it was this trusted partner. They weren't going to do this lightly. But as a result of the investigation, Dove Goldstein leaves TDC. Jason Lan goes to China. You might say he fled to China, but even after the investigation was over, someone didn't tell the spies to stop spying. Allison Kirby and some employees from TDC were having dinner on the top floor of a hotel to celebrate the investigation's conclusion. They look out the window, and there's a damn drone hovering outside the window watching them. When they approached the window, the drone dropped down suddenly to the ground level. Some men grabbed it and sped off in a white van. Again, really good cloak and dagger stuff. But in a response to the Bloomberg story, a lawyer from Jason Land said his client believes he has acted in compliance with all applicable laws and that his relationship to Dove Goldstein was of a professional nature and one that was appropriate in the circumstances. For Huawei's part, they said that they comply with applicable law and regulations and strives for the highest standards of business conduct. We deny any wrongdoing. TDC says, we recognize some of the things in Bloomberg's findings from our own files. As reported by Bloomberg, we conducted a broad and deep investigation, and all appropriate measures were taken accordingly. None of the employees directly mentioned by Bloomberg work for the company today. And yeah, it sounds like TDC, the whole reason we know this, the reason I'm able to talk about this, is that TDC had a totally different leak that actually leaked the story to the media. So it's kind of funny, but anyway. Now, Huawei's goals might have been more than just money. They weren't just trying to win a contract here. I mean, they wanted to win the contract, but it wasn't just for the money. It's highly suspected that Huawei is secretly run by the Chinese government. And that's not tinfoil hat stuff. It's a lot of countries, a lot of nations have suspected this for a while. China's economy basically seems like a bunch of ventriloquist dummies that are acting as companies with the Chinese government pulling all the strings. And there's just a string of stories going back years across all kinds of companies, and specifically Huawei, with some controversial moves they've made, as well as this constant suspicion that they're a puppet for the government. And in the case of Huawei and the TDC contract, the motive could have been so the Chinese government could spy more easily on other countries. You know, if you're setting up the 5G network, you could put bugs in listening devices anywhere to listen across the network. I mean, countries are each competing, after all, for status and resources, so they're all kind of competitors to each other. I mean, in 2024, President Joe Biden revoked 8 licenses that have allowed some companies to ship goods to Chinese telecom equipment giant Huawei over security concerns with Huawei. Someone told the executive branch something for them to be concerned about. I also want to just point out several other leading countries. I mean, they've all been caught spying. Russia, Israel, the UAE, the United States, of course, as well as many other countries. China is obviously not unique in this. Spying and stealing secrets is part of the underbelly of global politics. But next up, though, let's talk more about China. Specifically, I want to talk about the hacking group Apartment 41, also known as Double Dragon. Yeah, Double Dragon. You ever play that game? It was like a fighting game back in the early 90s. I think it was on Nintendo or Super Nintendo. I think they made several of them. But it's probably not a coincidence, that Double Dragon name. In the 2010s, a new group of hackers started to show up. They were highly skilled and used fairly advanced techniques to gain access to information, causing disruption, injecting malware, manipulating digital currencies, and other nefarious acts. They go by several names, and it seems to be this ever-changing cadre of people and names, and it's probably kind of hard to know who did what, but they go by Apartment 41, and they go by Double Dragon, and also Barium seems like a common one. The FBI even knows who some of their members are. They know 5 members: Zhang Horan, Tan Dilian, Qian Churan, and Fu Qiang, and Jiang Lizzy. And this is straight from the FBI Wanted Bulletin. I'm just going to read the bulletin. On August 11th, 2020, a grand jury in the District of Columbia returned an indictment against Chinese nationals, those five people on charges including racketeering, money laundering, fraud, identity theft, and access device fraud. These charges stem from their alleged unauthorized computer intrusions while employed by Chengdu 404 Network Technology Company. The defendants allegedly conducted supply chain attacks to gain unauthorized access to networks throughout the world, targeting hundreds of companies representing a broad array of industries to include social media, telecommunications, government, defense, education, and manufacturing. These victims included companies in Australia, Brazil, Germany, India, Japan, and Sweden. The defendants allegedly targeted telecommunications providers in the United States, Australia, China, well, Tibet, Chile, India, Indonesia, Malaysia, Pakistan, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, and Thailand. The defendants allegedly deployed ransomware attacks and demanded payments from victims. Jesus. So besides the FBI, there are several security companies with their eyes on Apartment 41. John Condra, Director of Strategic and Persistent Threats for INSICT Group, the research division of Massachusetts-based cybersecurity company Recorded Future. "We believe this activity is likely being conducted for intelligence purposes rather than financial gain due to the overlaps with previously reported cyber espionage campaigns." So he's basically calling out China's government, saying they're likely behind these hackers' activities. China's foreign ministry denied the accusations, saying this company has produced false information on so-called Chinese hacker attacks more than once in the past. Their relevant actions are groundless accusations, far-fetched, and lack professionalism. Chinese authorities consistently deny any form of state-sponsored hacking, of course. In 2019, the cybersecurity company FireEye stated with high confidence that the group was sponsored by the Chinese Communist Party. These devices they use are usually used for state-sponsored intelligence, devices meaning the software they use. And the name Double Dragon, that originates from the duality of their operation. Sure, it comes from a video game, but it originates from this duality of their operation as they engage in espionage on behalf of China on the one hand, and then also for their own personal financial gain on the other. Specifically, these guys are using espionage malware that is typically kept exclusive to the Chinese government. These include Home Unix, Keyplug, and Photo. And these are known malware that have been associated with Apartment 41, but previously they were only used by the Chinese government. I couldn't find details on what exactly these pieces of malware do. It's not really public information, but I will get into some of their techniques here shortly. Besides the type of malware they're using, though, they're apparently specifically targeting entities that align with targets of the Chinese government. So just looking back at the list FBI mentioned, many of the targets are in Southeast Asia or are considered unfriendly with the Chinese government. So how are they gaining access in the first place? How do they get the malware in? Well, spear phishing seems to be one of their main ways. That's where a hacker specifically targets an individual or specific group of people. Usually this is done through email, phone calls, and text messages. And they'll learn everything they can about a particular person or group and then try to send a malicious message that looks credible. It's all about credibility. So here's a quick example. Let's say I want to attempt to spear phish you. In this scenario, let's say you work at a warehouse, in the office, and you're in charge of invoicing. I learned you and your employer's boss's name from LinkedIn. I find out the type of business you do from your own website. I learn that your boss is in Tahiti, maybe, because he bragged about it on his out-of-office email autoresponse. So I assume that means he'll be hard to get into contact with. Perfect for me. Then I email you. I've got an urgent request. I mention your boss by name, and I say he needs me to make a payment to your company, so it's a payment to you, and I attach a PDF with some documentation. You open the PDF and it does nothing. There's nothing on there. It's just some, you know, it just says a whole lot of nothing, except it actually downloaded a keylogger so I can learn all of your passwords, because now I can see everything you type. Now I can learn how to log in as you, send all the phony invoices to your warehouse that I want, and approve the costs and send money to a designated bank account I control. Or maybe I just use you to get to the next person, maybe an even bigger fish, by assuming your identity through email message. So what's really bad is once these guys start to worm their way into an organization, they sort of like earn these new ways to be more credible, using your email being one example, maybe just learning enough information to spearfish a more important target. For another example, if apartment 41 were to quietly and carefully gain access to a lead developer at a video game company's to get access to their email, they could use that email to send other messages and gain further access by taking advantage of that person's credibility. So apartment 41, they also use like passive backdoors to a system, and it's very hard to detect these types of things. A good security company can look at all the outbound traffic leaving their network, carefully scan for anything malicious that shouldn't be going out. But what's harder to find is where there's a piece of software that's gotten placed somewhere in there that's just passively monitoring and, you know, learning passwords, stealing certificate information or other things. Another thing they could do is inject code into a software update. So like you're injecting code into the software that this game development company is working on, and then that gets pushed out into the entire network. So pushed out to all the users. And many times these guys are just trying to get to a point where they can just install ransomware too. And if you're not familiar with ransomware, it's a piece of software that can be installed on a computer or network that can just basically lock down all the data at the company and revoke access to the data unless the ransom is paid to a particular Bitcoin address. This kind of attack is kind of becoming commonplace now, unfortunately. Many different industries are being hit across all sectors. I mean, it's hitting smaller businesses even, not just Fortune 500 companies. Apparently, a few years ago, a small company from my own hometown, I mean, my hometown has 5,000 people in it, it was hit with multiple ransomware attacks, and they had to pay. I think they paid twice. Probably compromised through somebody's email in their office. You know, they probably weren't very technology forward, but Apartment 41 has hacked several governments and other entities, but all accounts seem to state that they've mostly targeted the video game industry. It's thought that this is more the moonlighting side of their hacking attempts. I really doubt that the Chinese government has that much interest in video games, but the thinking goes like this. These Apartment 41 guys, they likely have day jobs. The timing of their hacking activities apparently suggests this. Then at night, they have this double dragon persona, of course, where on the one hand, they have a list of maybe they have targets handed to them specifically from the Chinese government or just the Chinese Communist Party. It's basically the same thing. Then when the government doesn't have a specific target, these guys are probably hanging around gaming and also have these malicious tools that they already know how to use. Of course, they're going to try to hack the video games they're playing. They've stolen source code, digital certificates, attempted ransomware attacks against these game studios. Apparently, they've even repeatedly gained access to game development environments over the years. These guys have really dug their claws in deep. I wish I had more specifics on which video game companies, but most of this information is getting filtered through contracted security companies. So I'm guessing they're kind of beholden to just keep their targets anonymous. In one case reported by FireEye, Apartment 41 generated and sold virtual game currency that could have been worth up to $300,000. And they could go right up into the game development code, you know, and maybe they could try to hide some sneaky little piece of malware in hopes it gets distributed. Like I was saying earlier, you know, just have that pushed out to all their users. but here's a widely distributed video game. You know, it could get malware injected into its source code. So then it's coming right from the developer. That game could be going out to millions of people. Then when you think your computer is sleeping at night, these guys are either spying on you, or more likely they could potentially use the computer resources to commit a different attack, a DDoS attack. And a DDoS attack is really simple. They get this malicious code on a bunch of computers, many, many computers. Then they tell that malicious code to all go to the same web address or IP address at the exact same time. This then overloads the servers and the website goes down. So it's basically just like a retaliatory attack. You know, you've heard about, oh, this country's mad at this country, so they took their website down. That's a denial of service attack because they're sending so much information in, the servers can't handle it, prevents other normal users from using that website. And these groups of computers they compromise and attack with, they might not be home computers either. It could be anything with the capability of connecting to the internet, really. Anything that these hackers can infect to use on their behalf. And in the first half of 2024, it's believed that there are at least over 700,000 capable botnet nodes. So basically that many devices that are able to launch attacks or be a part of an attack. So with all the changes in technology coming, it's assured that these hackers like these are going to continue to exist. As we've seen, many are protected by their own governments. And it's not just China. There are hackers everywhere. Everywhere there's an internet connection, there's going to be hackers. It's an ever-present threat. So I'm a bit familiar with this field. It's one of the few areas I do feel confident in. My background is in IT, so I do have some knowledge in this topic. So I can't help myself. So indulge me for a second. Before we end the segment, I just want to give very quick security advice, just really fast. Some of you surely know this stuff already, but that means you know it's worth repeating then. So just three quick things to keep in mind for your own security. Use complicated passwords. That one's easy. Just always use complicated passwords. Make them slightly long. Make sure they're using more than just words. And if you can, use multi-factor authentication where, you know, you get a text message sent to your phone and you have to fill it out. It can be a bit of a pain, but do it. It's totally worth it. You just don't want to make it easy for these assholes. So the second thing I'd say is don't install or download anything from the web you aren't 100% sure is safe. You can really be sorry if you screw that up. If you're not sure about the website you're downloading from, just don't download from it. HTTPS is a good thing to keep in mind too. You shouldn't, you know, just avoid shady sites. The common sites that everybody knows about, most of those are going to be fine. Like Amazon and all the Google stuff, you know, they're doing the right things for the most part and protecting things. But you just have to do your own due diligence on some of the smaller, weirder sites. You don't want to be, you know, buying things off of some strange website that, you know, they might not have updated their website in 15 years and they're accepting credit card information. I would be a little leery of that. And the third thing, and this is most importantly, do not open attachments in email unless you have double checked exactly the full email address where it is coming from and you know who that is. Check the full email address. That's after the @. Make sure the website that it's from is spelled correctly. That's called typo squatting. Well, they'll change one letter in the website address. So it'll be like from some company name, but the letter spelling is quite slightly wrong. That's somebody trying to get you to click on that attachment. Always double check stuff like that. It's one of the biggest ways for hackers to gain access. And it's not pleasant, especially if it happens to you at work. So if you're curious about some common security threats, check out the OWASP Top 10. OWASP. They track the top 10 most common security threats annually, year after year, so people can kind of be aware of where they're most vulnerable and the things they should focus on. All right, okay. So let's shift out of the gloomy, seedy stuff and make a very poor transition into video games. The Apartment 41 guys seem to really like video games, but being hackers, they seem like they liked winning, you know? So video games gave the world this entirely new way to compete. Before the 1960s, basically no one played a video game. There was no video games to play. In 2024, there are well over 3 billion people playing video games. That's over one third of the planet. And that change happened in 60 years' time. It's wild. Imagine, think about that for a second. In 60 years, there could be a completely new thing that we don't know about right now, that we aren't talking about, we're unaware of really, and it could be ubiquitous in 60 years. Well, that's basically what video games were. That 60 years ago, nobody knew about them, nobody was playing them. They knew about board games and this and that, but nobody was playing video games. They had no idea what this was going to be like. So with that, let's talk about the story of specifically how console video games first started. Meet Ralph Baer. He's a very lucky man, born in 1922. He grew up in Nazi Germany. Okay, that doesn't sound very lucky, especially since he was Jewish. But hang in there. So Baer was expelled from his school when he was 14 years old on the basis that he was a Jew, and he was forced into an all-Jewish school around 1936. So over the next couple of years, him and his family saw this increased tension towards Jewish people in Germany, and so by 1938, they left Germany and headed to New York, and they were lucky to get out when they did. They left 2 months before Kristallnacht, and Baer would have been about 16 years old at the time, and Kristallnacht was known as the Night of the Broken Glass. I think that's what Kristallnacht means. It was a violent anti-Semitic program that occurred across the entire Reich. It sounded like a freaking nightmare. At the time, Germany had annexed Austria and occupied Sudetenland. It was happening all over the Reich. And this was kind of that turning point where whatever very few rights Jewish people had left in Germany and the Reich at this time, it was basically completely dissolved in that day. They had no rights. There were all kinds of trouble after that. Over 1,000 synagogues were burned. 7,500 Jewish-owned businesses were ransacked and looted. I mean, it's like practically anarchy against the Jewish people. Many Jews were killed, but many were rounded up. At least 30,000 Jewish men were arrested and sent to concentration camps over those few days. And we all know it got worse from there, but you've probably seen some version of this in the movie, you know, where the Nazis show up to a Jewish family's house, just start throwing things out the windows, out the door, just without saying anything. They just cart off the men in the house. Just terrifying stuff. It's basically the ultimate fear we have of an authoritarian government. Probably why Nazi history, you know, kind of is like, you just constantly hear about it, right? It's because they embody that like perfect fear a family has. So I think I've painted a pretty good picture of what happened here. You know, Ralph Baer's really, that's his first big break, is that he escaped the Nazis, and they had to know how lucky they were. But more luck would come his way. Luck he kind of made for himself, to be honest, though. Baer became a naturalized citizen. You know, him and his family moved to New York, and he was just at a bus station, and he saw a poster about education in an electronics field. And so just like that, he immediately decided to pursue a degree. And by 1940, he had a degree as a radio service technician. Well, that's pretty nifty. He's only 18 and he's got a degree. Man, it just feels like things were simpler back then. I mean, they were in the middle of World War, but never mind. Anyway, but in 1943, he was drafted in to fight in World War II. Well, shit, right? But no, he kind of lucked out again. His degree probably helped him end up in military intelligence instead of jumping off a boat on Omaha Beach. But it wasn't just his degree, though. He was a young man from Germany. He was a treasure trove of information for the intelligence community. And he apparently spent a lot of time writing about German history, weapons, the military and culture, and he gave lectures and educated personnel about the German enemy, you know, just so they knew what they were up against. So then he was sent to Liverpool in the UK for a short while, but also he went to Paris. Soldiers really liked him because he would build radios out of German mine detectors so that they could listen to music and radio programming. I think that's pretty cool. He had to be a popular guy just for that. Bet he could fix my e-bike, goddammit. But anyway, his war duties would carry until 1946, and then he'd return home. But with him, he took a bunch of weapons and apparently to present, to museums around the USA. Kind of a weird little detail. Apparently, he'd been obsessed with learning about weapons overseas so much that he even ended up like publishing a book about weapons later. So with his GI Bill then after the war, he was able to then go back to school and get a bachelor's degree in television engineering. Television engineering, a bachelor's degree in television engineering. How about that? These days, you couldn't imagine someone getting a degree specifically in television engineering. It seems like the closest thing there is today is like broadcast engineering, but televisions were really growing as a thing at the time. You know, in the late 40s, everyone was starting to have their own TV in the home. So obviously, this was a really solid career move. So now in 1949, Bayer would work at several electronics companies to various degrees, to various capacities, you know, kind of working his way up the ladder, cutting his teeth, probably becoming an expert in his field, really. He seems like he did. And in 1956, he went to work for a defense contractor named Sanders Associates, and this would be in Nashua, New Hampshire. And there, he oversaw 500 engineers in the development of electronic systems that were being used for military applications. So while at Sanders, Bayer had this idea. He'd been there for about 10 years or so at the time. It's 1966, and he recalled this previous idea that he'd had over a decade before, and he kind of wanted to revisit it. So with television sets being in every home, he thought it would be really interesting to make something for the television besides its normal function. He decided it could be used to play games, and he started working on this proposal, this idea for a game box that would plug into a television screen. The device would send a signal to the television screen that could tune it in like a channel, and that channel would be referred to as LP, which actually stood for Let's Play. So here's the state of the video games industry in 1966. It was this. There were no arcade games. There were no other video game consoles. The only games that were made were at large institutions like Space War was a game. It's considered the first video game, and it was developed at Stanford. But this was more of a novelty shared across campuses. It's basically the only places that had large computers at the time. So this was the only place to play video games. And so, you know, you got this elite few kids at these Ivy League schools playing video games, and that's really it. It's kind of a novelty. So this console idea of Bayer's at the time, it's kind of revolutionary. It kind of seems to kind of born out of, you know, not a whole lot of, no need, but he could kind of see that the need would come. It's taking a lot of concepts at the time, though, and smashing them together. Like, you know, board games were very popular at the time. Of course, sports were popular as they are today. Television was gaining incredibly in popularity. And then there were these computers that were getting smaller and smaller all the time. And of course, Ralph Bayer understood technology and computers, and he knew the potential. So, like I said, the company Bayer worked for at the time was Saunders. They were a military contractor. Decades later, they'd be folded into BAE, for example, but in the 1960s, they made circuitry for the US military. Making a game box was way outside of their business model. So Bayer and his colleague, Bob Tremblay, picked an empty room and they started developing a prototype to show their bosses. So this was kind of like a little renegade side project, you know, well, let's give them something to look at first before we, before we really talk to them and try to propose anything. So in December of 1966, they had completed an initial prototype with the beautiful name of TV Game Number One. Great naming, guys. You should have maybe brought the marketing guy in on that a little bit, but all it could do is it could display a vertical line on the television screen and move it around. And so, okay, baby steps, but that was kind of a big step, right? He figured out how to control the signal with a device outside of the TV, a device that he physically controlled. That was a first, and it was a big step towards video game stardom. Just that. It all started with that one vertical line moving back and forth. My, how things have changed. So they showed this to their boss, who then approved a small budget to let them proceed on further development. They created a game where two people competed to fill buckets of water by rapidly clicking a button. Okay, that's better than moving a line. Eventually, they made a shooting game and then a game where dots chased each other around. Finally, Bear would present this to the board of Sanders. The CEO and the board weren't overly enthusiastic. Surprise, surprise, old crusty men didn't have any vision, but they did let Bear seek to develop a more refined prototype so they could license and sell the game box as a commercial product. So I guess we should give them some credit, huh? So now Ralph Bear was an electronics guy. He wasn't really good at game design. You know, he knew it. He knew he wasn't good at it. I mean, he's making games where you fill buckets and chase dots around. So he brought in Bill Rausch to help design games. Bill was apparently a bit difficult to work with, a little prickly, it sounds like. But it sounds like it was worth dealing with him because he figured out a way to have a third independent component that wasn't controlled by either player that moved on its own. With this, he proposed a ping pong type game. And with that, the very first NPC would be that little dot on their table tennis game. So now they've got this ping pong game. They've got a few other games now. So in November of 1967, they have their fourth prototype. And this one has the ping pong game, a chasing game, a light gun game, and three types of controllers. They had joysticks, a rifle. I can't believe they had a rifle, but yes, they had a rifle like Duck Hunt, sort of. And a three-dialed controller for like the ping pong type game, the table tennis game. And they were ready to look for a manufacturer to buy the idea. But the next year was a little difficult. There was an economic downturn and layoffs were happening in the electronics sector. And so this included Sanders and also the people they were also trying to sell this product to. So nobody was really interested in investing in new things. So the project was kind of shelved for a bit. But in 1969, the project, now in its seventh prototype, so they just had a year to refine it. Wait, one way of looking at it. This seventh prototype is the famous brown box, named for the wood grain stickers on the casing. They started talking to TV manufacturers to see if they were interested in the idea. And they approached several, but RCA was the only one interested. But they just could never come to an agreement with RCA, apparently. And so no deal ever happened. Man, RCA, this is why you're not Sony. This is why you're not Microsoft. You fucked up here. However, RCA executive Bill Enders left RCA for Magnavox, and he convinced Magnavox to take another look at the brown box. So they apparently had looked at it before and weren't really interested, but this guy shows up and he says, hey, come on, look at this thing. So they did a new demonstration for Magnavox in July 1969. Again, no wild enthusiasm, but the president of Magnavox liked it, so Magnavox agreed to produce the console. It took a while to come to an agreement, like a year and a half, but they did finally settle in January of 1971. It must have been something to do with like the share or like who got what profits, you know. So this console would, of course, be released as the Magnavox Odyssey. And the price of the system, you know, that apparently the marketing team got a hold of this thing because Magnavox added paper money and playing cards and poker chips to the console to go along with the plastic. They had plastic overlays for the game for the screen. And Bayer thought it was kind of silly. This would make the console more expensive than Bayer's Vision. It was sold for $99 when he originally wanted to sell it for like $25. Added to this, Magnavox only sold the console at its own dealerships, which implied to the public that the console would only work on Magnavox television, which wasn't true. It'd work on any TV. So some sources say the dealers were actually behind this in some cases. Like they were just trying to sell more TVs, you know, a salesperson doing salesy, sleazy things. So they would overcome some of these issues. They did get the price down to $50 eventually, and they sold fairly well. In 1972, they sold 69,000 units. In 1973, they sold 89,000. In 74, they sold 129,000. And then in 75, it dipped down to 80,000 again. And the Odyssey, over this course, the Odyssey would be upgraded and changed over those years, but they were about to be killed by Atari, a small company, in 1977. So let's check in with Nolan Bushnell's Atari and their collision with Ralph Baer's Odyssey. I'm not going to go deep on Nolan Bushnell. He's put his story out there so many times. What I want to talk about, though, is Pong and how Atari kind of just stole that idea from Magnavox, from the Magnavox Odyssey. So Atari was started by Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney, and basically they played the game Space War at Stanford and had a spin-off game that they were designing based on that. Based on Space War, though it seemed like it was supposed to be like a more complicated space game. They also got this idea to make it a coin-operated arcade-style game, and that's how they kind of first developed Atari as a company and envisioned the company would be. So they were envisioning how an arcade game would work. And this is happening basically at the same time that Bayer was over at Sanders trying to develop his game box and settle on a deal with Magnavox. So they were kind of developing in parallel, but in different directions. Atari was kind of going for that arcade coin system, you know, which we all know arcade games, you know, probably based on pinball machines, but they wanted to do video games this way. Okay. So the Odyssey was released in 1972, and one of the games on it is table tennis. It's a ping pong like game. And Nolan Bushnell actually had seen an early demo of the Odyssey before it was released. So we got a look at this table tennis ping pong game. And then Bushnell set out to create his own version. And he tasked Al Alcorn with developing a game similar to the table tennis game on the Magnavox Odyssey. So Bushnell says that they actually wanted a driving game to be their first game. And the ping pong game was supposed to be more of a proof of concept for Al Alcorn so he could learn how to program for the arcade box. Well, whatever the case may be, once their version of the ping pong table tennis type game was made, they found it to be a lot of fun. They really enjoyed it. Al Alcorn, for his part, he didn't know where Bushnell had even gotten the inspiration for this ping pong game, as the Odyssey hadn't been released yet and Bushnell never told him. So I don't know if you want to call this corporate espionage or not, but I don't know. Think of it this way. If this were some new type of treatment for cancer or a specialized drill bit or a new type of transistor, I would sure say, yeah, this is definitely some kind of corporate espionage, spying and stealing secrets and sort of copying them. But Bushnell kind of gets away with it, at least in the public eye. I don't know. It just didn't sit quite right to me. Like, he kind of got a pass, but he did not get a pass from Magnavox, as we'll see. So, of course, Atari famously releases Pong as an arcade game in November of 1972, and it was a smash hit on the arcade. And so, the same year as the Odyssey is released as a console with the Odyssey version of this ping pong table tennis game, Atari's version of Pong is released the same year as an arcade game. But Pong had sound, and it was smoother, and the game on the Odyssey just wasn't as good, apparently. So as far as anyone in 1972 cared, Pong wasn't some copy of anything. It was Pong. It was fun, and that's what people were focused on. By 1974, Pong would be released as a home console game called Home Pong. Of course, this sold like crazy. But yeah, Magnavox was not pleased. In April of 1974, Magnavox had filed a suit against Atari, arguing that they infringed on Sanders Associates' patents. So long story short, Atari did end up settling with Magnavox for $1.5 million over 8 installments. But Magnavox also obtained the rights to full information on Atari products over the next year, so that's 1976 going into 1977. The Atari 2600 is said to have been delayed a few months in 1977 just so they didn't have to disclose anything to Magnavox. So after that, the Atari 2600 was released, and it was basically over for the Magnavox Odyssey, even if they didn't know it. I mean, they'd already stopped production. They'd kind of given up beforehand. But the Atari 2600 hit the timing of technology just a little bit better than Magnavox. They weren't too early, or maybe they were, because you could consider that Nintendo would crush them in the next decade, but we're not going to talk about that. But the Atari had something big on their side, though. They had the games, the game library, and the games were fun, and they just did a better job at marketing, it sounds like. They also had a better system for swapping out cartridges, which was a novel idea at the time, and basically allowed them to have as many games in the system as they could develop. The Odyssey did have something like that called game cards, but they weren't as sophisticated, and they fell behind Atari's technology really quickly. Essentially, Atari owes a lot of its success to Ralph Baer and his team, though, not only for the success of Pong, but the Odyssey acted like a market testing tool, and they got the general public familiar with the concept of this home video game console system. Atari would go on to sell 30 million units of the 2600, and the world would be changed forever. Video games have climbed in popularity ever since. Like I said, 3 billion people. It's kind of like saying the sky is blue at this point. Yeah, video games are popular. Duh, everybody knows that. Personally, even though I never imagined video games would be as popular as they are today, I grew up playing video games, and yeah, they were popular, but not this popular. It's pretty wild. But now, let's take a look at where video games have gone and the competition that have been born from all these video games over the years. So the first console had two controllers, two players, immediately allowing for competition in games between people. And the first games were competitive. Hit the button as fast as you can to fill that water bucket, remember? And video games, they've just always been competitive. They're always going to be. There's always been other types of games too, though, like adventure games and simulator type games, but competitive games have just always been right there, and they're always selling like hotcakes. They're a very popular category of games. So I'll disclose that I'm not really much of a competitive gamer at all. I don't Twitch stream or anything like that. I grew up back in the days where you did a LAN party or directly dialed into another computer to play competitively. I was only competitive in like small groups with friends. So my first competitive, in quotes, gaming experience would probably be like playing Command & Conquer Red Alert against a friend, where one of us would actually dial into the other person's computer with a modem. Like your computer had to call the other computer in the phone back then, and basically they're carrying on a conversation in computer bits while you played your game. And, we'd play Red Alert, and we'd battle it out for resources, and our armies would attack each other. Maybe you'd use Tanya to blow up the base. Chew on this. But what a time. It was great. Then I'd go on to play games, I'd play some competitive video games, like GoldenEye. I'll admit, that's probably where I peaked in gaming. I would play as the Baron, Samedi. He's the guy with the top hat, with the maps. With the maps all memorized, I used to just wipe the floor with my friends. Then I'd play like my older brother once, and I'd play with his friends. And that was some real confidence building for me. I gotta say, I wiped the floor with all of them. Anyway, I'm just reminiscing. Something about that game, the Nintendo 64, it had support for four players on the console and was just uniquely fun, especially whooping ass. Anyway, I was, you know, I've since gone back and played that and I'm really bad now. Terrible. And, you know, I probably wasn't even that good. It was just they all sucked. But anyway, you know, I'd go on and I'd play Halo and Call of Duty online a little bit, but nothing much. I really wasn't nearly as good against the rest of the world. It wasn't as fun playing against random people who yelled obscenities at you, you know, weird. But so Space War, which is really the first video computer game, it was actually a tournament, or they had a tournament held at Stanford in 1972. Later, Space Invaders, an Atari game, held a tournament in 1980 with over 10,000 participants. That's pretty wild. And arcade games have been competitive basically since their inception. There's been tournaments every year going back decades to compete for high score on a game or to take home a cash prize. A lot of it's just straight out promotion for the arcade, you know. In-person arcades, you know, they do tournaments to try to attract people to come and play. You know, they want to, you know, drum up business, baby. But I think an offshoot of this, though, with the competition would be like the video game speedruns. You know, nearly every game that has a beginning and an end has someone who's done a speedrun to try and beat the game as fast as possible. So for a personal example, in the home base of my company I work for, there's a few guys at the main office that like to do speedruns for games like Contra and Mega Man 2. It's pretty ridiculous, but they seem to like it. It's just that iterative nature of making these small adjustments. Oh, I ran this way, and then I got to do this differently. And I can't believe that people like doing that, but, you know, people have weird interests. I can't believe people even speedrun long games. Games that took me like hundreds of hours to complete, like Final Fantasy VII, which is kind of a story-based role-playing game. I always think of it as playing it casually. It's almost like you're watching a movie, sort of. It's interactive, but someone beat that game in 7 hours and 25 minutes. It's just unreal how much effort, planning, and dedication some of these speedruns have put into them. But let's get back to shooters a little bit. Easily one of the most popular video game categories, especially among competitive gamers. Even if you haven't played a single video game, I'm sure you've heard of Call of Duty or Fortnite. Flossing and all that jazz. I don't know. I didn't really get into that stuff. It's just past my time, I think, you know, especially Fortnite. But these popular shooter games of 2024 have many, many predecessors who carved out this entire industry, mostly back in the 90s. So 1993, the video game Doom comes out for personal computer. And I was fortunate enough to have a dad who loved computers and video games. So we had Doom. And of course, we also had Wolfenstein too. But these games were great shoot 'em ups. Doom was especially fun. It was bloody, had really cool guns, and you fought demons running around some sci-fi army base on Mars. I mean, I was a 10-year-old boy. I mean, this is what dreams were made of for a 10-year-old boy, you know? Doom actually had a tournament called Deathmatch 95, which could be considered one of the first big online gaming tournaments. And they played several qualification rounds, and 22 participants would compete in the finals in Seattle. So this helped establish this whole concept of first-person shooter competitions. The game Quake was the next big revolution, and it was a big revolution. John Carmack is kind of a legend in the video game industry for developing the Quake engine, which is a gaming engine for video games. And think of a gaming engine as like a toolbox and a framework for developers. It takes care of the really technical parts of creating a game, like actually displaying the 3D graphics. This way, the developer of the games can focus on the actual gameplay development and not have to build up each game as this standalone, independent piece of software. They have this like framework or scaffolding that they can build from. So Quake is a 3D shooter that uses this new game engine. And it was a big upgrade from Doom's graphics. Quake and Doom were both made by id Software, ID software, so they had a similar feel and attracted the same audience. What makes the Quake engine so powerful was that it was a true 3D gaming engine. This was an upgrade over Doom's engine, which was considered to be like a 2.5D graphics. It kind of used some tricks to kind of seem like it was 3D, but the Quake engine could do like dynamic lighting and put shadows on the screen. Both of these games, they sold very well. In the millions for both of these games, they sold millions and millions of copies. But this would begin the 3D shooter escalation that seems like might actually be peaking out, or did it already peak out? Or I don't know, maybe I've just peaked out. I don't know, I'm old. But QuakeCon would start in 1996, and it would basically be a large LAN party. These LAN parties would grow every year, and by 2004, they would have a 3,000-person QuakeCon. Yeah, so if I'm understanding this correctly, there's 3,000 people that got together. They brought their computers with them. You actually had to take your computer, probably a big bulky desktop if you wanted to have any kind of computer that would play these games, and they would bring their giant, big, heavy monitors, and they'd meet in one place for these giant conventions. And LAN stands for local area network. So these parties are everyone is in the same place, basically. It'd be like a giant social gathering where you brought your computer, connected it to the network, and played video games and partied all night. It sounds awesome. So as someone who grew up in a rural community and was really into video games, I was just a little too young and too far from where these events were held to ever get a chance to be in one. I would have loved to go to a LAN party. It sounds like it was awesome. The closest thing I ever did was playing Halo with about 12 guys. We connected a bunch of Xboxes. I think you could like network them together and do like a LAN game. I'm pretty sure it was Halo 2, and we were playing together over a local area network, and it was late 2004, so I think it actually might have been the weekend that Halo 2 was released was when we did this. I think we did it a few times, but it's been so long ago. But anyway, QuakeCon is this giant in-person tournament. It continues to this day. Newer versions with big, there's a big deathmatch tournament. It's taken very seriously by its competitors, though it's not nearly as, I don't think it's nearly as popular as it used to be. There's just so many other big games now. But in 1999, Counter-Strike, that was a big one, though this was when things started getting played over the internet more. You know, you're not doing LAN parties necessarily. You're playing against each other over the internet. And it kind of kills this LAN party vibe eventually, you know, replaced by children yelling obscenities at middle-aged men while squatting on their face or whatever. You know, this is where all that kind of started. Messaging to each other would be common, you know, GG sarcastically at the end of the game, or clutch or kick was another one, apparently, is a phrase used when you were the last one on your team alive and you're expected to win or you're going to get kicked from the server. So then there's B-hop or bunny hop apparently came from this game, where people repeatedly would jump. It's like a technique you did in these games where you jump because it made you move faster. So anyway, lots of inside baseball terminology on all these video games. And these days I'm completely out of touch with it. So another type of game besides shooters that had a big online presence was real-time strategy games. I mentioned playing Command & Conquer Red Alert, which was one of these early RTS strategy games. But the big one, the big bad Leroy Brown of online RTS games, I think was probably StarCraft. And this game was released in 1998, and it's still fun to this day. It's still played to this day. It's sort of a sci-fi real-time strategy game where you can play as one of three different races and either play the story mode of the game or play campaigns against the computer itself or your friends online. You all have like your own armies and you're fighting each other. This game is played to this day online and often. The game does have a sequel, which is probably, it's probably more popular than the first version. I honestly don't know which one's more popular still. I probably should have looked that up. But anyway, the Esports World Cup in 2024, there were 18 players competing for a prize pool, and this is StarCraft II, and the prize pool was worth over $1 million, the first place winner taking home $400,000. So it's a very big big game. So that brings up esports. In 2000, the Korean Minister of Culture would coin the word esports by combining the words electronics and sports. And this was kind of a turning point where this type of competition started to have, you know, it had a name now, and it just, this whole idea of esports started to grow. So besides RTS and shooters, there are all kinds of tournaments. You know, there's Super Smash Brothers. That tournament started in 1999, and it continues to this day. Super Smash Brothers is a multiplayer fighting game where characters from a bunch of different video games are all in this game fighting each other in this like deathmatch style where everyone is against everyone. Or there's sometimes there's teams, depending on the tournament, probably. Then there's the, you know, other games would be like, then there's the big MMO games, which are massively multiplayer online games. And like World of Warcraft, which you've probably heard of, which is consistently the biggest, most popular of these types of games. There's sports leagues and racing leagues. Basically, today, for every type of video game, there's some kind of official competition for it. It's just part of the video game culture at this point, like it or not. As of 2023, the global esports market is worth around $2.3 billion. The year before, it was $1.7 billion. So it's expected to grow over $15 billion by the 2030s. So this competition, it's just in people's blood. Online competitive video games is just another branch of this. With virtual and augmented reality slowly getting more popular, the landscape of video games and esports competition in general is bound to make even greater changes in the coming decades. But like I say, 60 years, we went from nothing to all over 3 billion of us playing video games. Who knows what that means in 60 years? It's probably nothing any of us are really expecting. You know, I'm always looking for a theme to observe in each episode to kind of tie the episode together, right? Well, competition was obviously going to be the theme for this episode. But even through all this content, it wasn't entirely clear to me, well, what drives people to be so competitive? Why are we like this? If you listen to like philosophers like Nietzsche, you get a seemingly clear answer. At one point, he considered life to be driven by a will to power. He saw competition inherent in nearly everything, even love. But as I understand it, his concept of will to power, it just kind of changed over the years. And it was really only compiled into an idea after he died. But of course, there are other competing ideas about competition. Many philosophers seem to believe that competition has excessive focus. Basically, I think they're advocating that excessive competition is ultimately bad for society. Some would argue that there are more practical and efficient ways to advance ourselves without resorting to these primal tendencies. I would kind of have to agree with that. In my mind, competition does have to do with power, but power, I think, isn't it ultimately to do with the need to feel secure in oneself and protect one's assets or loved ones? In some ways, I think if people are going to believe they're always run by their primal tendencies, then they're ultimately run by fear. But that doesn't seem to be really what drives everyone with competition, right? I mean, we aren't playing video games for power or to protect ourselves. Who tries to climb the leaderboard of Call of Duty to seek power, to protect what's theirs? No, it's about glory, right? And ultimately, I think it's about feeling a purpose within oneself. So in my mind, you can have competition that's driven by glory or competitions driven by fear, but they still don't say anything about morality through competition. There are plenty of people who are highly competitive and do so ethically. Look at the Olympics. There are plenty of competitors who aren't cheating. Sure, there are some that are and have been caught, spectacularly caught, but there's plenty of competitors who aren't cheating. So there's a lot of talk recently about capitalism these days and how it's been rotting democracy from the inside out. Currently, there's a billionaire, Elon Musk, who is basically trying to buy an election. It's pretty straightforward. He's not really hiding it very well. But the point I would make here is that no matter the system, if there are people with low morals who have a path to power, then any economic system can be compromised. I believe more and more that the key to a more abundant society lies more in advancing our ethical principles than in treating each other with more respect. It's kind of the obvious answer, but it's also the most difficult solution. Anyway, okay, that's enough about my musings about competition. Let's go on to the character summary. Okay, the character review. Larry Ellison and Oracle, the aggressive leader of an aggressive company that paid people to look at garbage, the law firm with an IT department. And I'd like to take this moment to point out that this podcast and episode is, in particular, is satire and should not be a grounds for legal action against me or my podcast. Thank you. Then you've got Bill Gates and Microsoft, an equally sharky company that dominated the software industry. Could talk all kinds of weird things about Bill Gates, but let's not get into that. Then you've got John Ashcroft, the definitely not a sleazeball who went from being an attorney general of the United States to being a consultant for a software company that he sued the year before. So I'm calling him the scumbag of the episode for that. Or the asshole of the episode. I think that's what I agreed to call it. Man, I really need to get this terminology right. Anyway. Okay. Then you've got Harold Warden, the retired Kodak employee who tried to steal secrets from them. Funny enough, Kodak at the time would soon hardly have any secrets worth stealing when digital cameras flooded the market and made their industry basically obsolete. Then there's Patricia Dunn, the chairman of the board at HP, who investigated her colleagues at HP. Trust issues, Pat. Trust issues. Then there's Robert Fortune, the James Bond of the tea theft game, who stole intellectual property long before those words had any official meaning. Then there's TDC, who handled an internal leak really quite well. I thought they handled that whole thing really well. And by the way, I don't know that I mentioned it, but Ericsson did get the contract in the end. I should have probably said that up front, but yes, Ericsson won the contract. Huawei lost it. Wah, wah, wah. Anyway, Dove Goldstein, the guy who leaked the information, and probably for, you know, he probably did it for a personal financial gain, but who knows exactly. Then there's Jason Lan and Huawei. They almost certainly, I mean, we know Jason Lan was the one spying, and he worked for Huawei. So, yeah, it was pretty obvious what they were doing there. And then there's Apartment 41, the hacker group also known as Double Dragon, who are almost certainly working for the Chinese government when they're not playing video games and goofing off. And then there's Ralph Baer, the hero of the episode, pioneered video games and invented a whole new category of entertainment. He's a legend along with Bill Rausch and Bob Tremblay and really any of the other guys that worked on the early game that would be the Magnavox prototype. Then there's Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney, the creators of Atari. I was probably a bit hard on them earlier, but you kind of have to call a spade, despite the sort of legendary status these guys in Atari have. I still think they deserve much of the success they got. After all, Pong wasn't nearly the only reason that Atari was successful. I think they would have came out on top even if they hadn't ripped off Pong. Then there's John Carmack at id Software. The guy is a legend for revolutionizing video games, and he really sort of pushed the whole industry to that next level in the 90s. And then finally, I'd like to thank the Baron Samedi, the character from GoldenEye Video, the video game that helped me beat up on my friends and my brother's friends. Sir, I will forever be in your debt. And because I like to close with a thought-provoking quote, let's end with an inspirational quote from Ralph Baer. He said, "Pong is simply a knockoff of the Odyssey ping pong game." Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said that. But okay, here's an actual inspirational quote from Bayer. Coming up with ideas isn't hard. The real challenge is finding the time to actually build something and then finding a home for it. Thank you so much for listening to Meridians. I really appreciate it. If you have any feedback for the episode, email feedback@meridianspodcast.com. If you want to read some companion articles I've written for the show, check out my Substack, meridianspodcast.substack.com. All right. Until next time, I'm Charlie Noble, and thanks for listening.